And good evening. It is Intuitive Soul Radio with your host, Lori Houston. And tonight we get to the second part of our program where I get to interview an author. And I have Johanna Magel on the line, who is the author of The Prodigal Family, A Spiritual Roadmap for Family Reconciliation. It is a very interesting book that I think a lot of people would benefit from reading, because it really helps us to look at our family dynamics in a way that I'm not sure everybody does. So welcome, Johanna.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me, Lori. I'm happy to be here.
Great. So why don't we start a little bit with what your journey has been, and then we'll talk about the book, because it all sort of fits in anyway. But tell us, what, you know, how did you get to where you are?
Well, I had, how did I get to where I am? Well, let's see. I had, 2 years ago, I had an experience where I had to undergo treatment for breast cancer. And as people who've been through that know, it's not so much the disease that is challenging, but the treatment for the disease. Mm-hmm. And it leaves you in a state where you are pretty much incapacitated for a good amount of time. And in that state of incapacitation, you actually get a chance to sort of reflect on your life in a way that maybe you haven't before. And for me, that reflection came about in the form of looking at my family and realizing that there have been generations in my own family, and, you know, in my husband's family as well, of really what I would classify as non-reconciliation. And so starting to look at that, I started to trace my own steps into my own childhood and realized that for many years I had spent time really looking at family dynamics in an almost mathematical way and trying to understand what it is, where, what happens, what goes on where people seem to have almost a resistance to, you know, forgiveness and reconciliation, but primarily humility, I think, is what is the, you know, underlying thing that needs to be there to trigger those other things. So anyway, I think in my own journey, I started to understand that looking at families, as you say, differently involves kind of a, more of a spiritual perspective of understanding the ancestry that you come from and having compassion, you know, for your parents, your grandparents, and what that is about. So I hope that kind of explains a little bit about what the book is, where, you know, the journey the book takes us on as well.
Right. And, I mean, the whole, it all came together in a very nice way by using the parable of the prodigal son. And I think,
yeah,
you know, that part of that has allowed you to, again, understand, I guess, the humiliation part and the forgiveness part, which is interesting. And like in the parable, you know, one of the, and we'll talk about this, but one of the things that I found, you know, very unique was when you talked about siblings, because I think, you know, that triangle again that we have, and again, we'll talk about this because it's all in the book, but, you know, that is a very unique aspect of growing up. And there are often difficulties with our siblings. And in The Prodigal Son, it certainly was the, you know, the other brother that, you know, felt the jealousy and the resentment and the pain versus, you know, the father or, you know, the son who came home. But so talk a little bit maybe about how the prodigal son sort of brought together this book.
Yeah, well, you know, as I talk about in the very, very beginning of the book, I had an experience with my husband actually going to confession, mm-hmm, and having the discussion come up about the parable of the prodigal son, and that I didn't really understand the story, or I wasn't really deeply familiar with the story. And I started reading it. That is actually what really resonated to me. What you were talking about was the dynamic of, you know, a father and a son, or, you know, a child and a parent is pretty direct. And so the fact that the one son goes off and he loses himself and finds himself and comes home in a very classic hero's journey type of way. But then there's the other son, like you mentioned, he's just home being a good boy. He's just doing the things that he thinks he's supposed to do. and in a sense becomes very resentful of the other brother for, you know, squandering all this stuff and then coming home and being celebrated. So I think that whole paradigm of having the sibling rivalry, the sibling jealousy, is very underrated. And what happens, I think, in a lot of situations is that in families where maybe there is some reconciliation around issues of, you know, where things haven't, where there has been difficulty, the sibling relationship, I think, is the one that suffers the most because there is a third person in the room spiritually. It may not be there physically, but a parent is often still in the room in that relationship, and the two siblings that are struggling might not even understand that on a conscious level. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a very good point you bring up about that story, and that's a lot of why I do write about sibling relationships. And, you know, my husband and I, between the two of us, I guess we have, 12, 13 siblings. Wow. So there's a lot of people, you know, that are now grown-ups that we're trying to have relationships with. And you think about the dynamic of that and the power that the parents have to, you know, or have had to affect those relationships. It's very interesting.
Mm-hmm. And you're also very honest about, you know, your own journey and how sometimes the lights are on and you're enthusiastic and joyful, and there are other days where, you know, making peace with the voices of the past, you know, is a bit of a struggle. And I think, you know, understanding and accepting and, you know, being very authentic in, you know, our own journey and what it's allowed us to grow from and with, that, you know, I think it's really important to be real.
And you know, when I was working with my editor, when I first put this book out into the world, I took a sort of more almost clinical approach, I think, initially to how I went to present my take on all this. And, you know, he made a good point. He said, you know, if you really want to earn people's trust, if you want to take people on this journey with you, you're going to have to share. And because if you want to encourage other people to share and be honest, you have to do it yourself. Mm-hmm. And I understand that there is a huge risk in that. I mean, I do understand that when you put yourself out there and you're honest, you open yourself up for a lot of things. I mean, when I put this book into the world, I hope that it will resonate with people and it will have some meaning for people who otherwise wouldn't have had this sort of, I don't know, way of looking at things. But the reality is also that I have a family. And so then I have to kind of take that in, that I have a family. Now I'm putting all this stuff out there, and how does that affect them? So I appreciate that you would bring that up, because I think the more people can be honest, the more we can start to get real and turn the lights on, as you say, and look at things more openly, which is ultimately the way that they're going to be healed, is by having them brought into the light.
Exactly. Yeah, and there's too many people out there in the spiritual realm who believe, you know, detachment is the way to go. And I do think that, you know, a lot of it is misunderstood by what their original intention of it is. But, you know, we've already done the stuffing away and holding back and the addictions to not look at. And, you know, we need to start being real. We need to be authentic. We need to be able to look into ourselves and, you know, understand the beliefs and the pain that we hold.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that it really is nothing more than that. I mean, it's just about being real and putting it out there. And I know you and I are both big fans of David Berselli, and mm-hmm. I know in his work, that's one of the things I really appreciate, is how he really addresses the issue of, you know, what does our physical body hold, and the truths that our physical body holds are important, and that we can't go into a place of enlightenment through detachment if our body is trying to talk to us and share stories that need to be shared. And so one of the things I talk about, as you know, in the book, is the five circles, mm-hmm. and that sort of metaphor for our lives. And the second circle is the embodiment of our ego and our physical bodies. And if the girth of that circle gets too wide or too big, it's really hard to have a balanced, integrated life. And what that circle is trying to say to us is that, here, I need you to take this. I need you to take this away from me. I need you to look at this and help me process it so that it can be released.
Right.
And you can't really do that through detachment. I think detachment is appropriate in certain situations spiritually, but I think when it comes to family healing, there are things that need to be looked at. There are things that need to be addressed, and it's nothing more than that. It's just they need to be heard.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the four principles of family healing. Your first one is take no prisoners.
Yeah. And I bring that up because I think that a lot of times people think that, well, I will begin my journey of family healing once so-and-so in my family is ready, or so-and-so changes or grows or stops drinking or whatever it is that they're looking for somebody else in their family to change. And so the first step is just realizing nobody else is going to change. The change is within me.
Yeah. Yeah. And learning to see the bigger picture instead of their story. And yeah, I mean, it really is about focus and intention and, you know, what it is that we want to achieve.
Yeah, exactly.
And number two, we must heal around that which cannot be healed. I like that.
Yeah, that's actually my favorite. And I had somebody else, you know, a guide who's helped me a lot in the last few years kind of point that out to me. And I never really looked at it that way. But, you know, when you have things that have gone down in your own family that are very powerful, and so much so, and here's another piece to the compassion aspect of all this, is that there are some things that families endure that are so painful that literally people believe that if they were to face them, it would destroy them. And so it's almost a respect of that. You know, if you have the courage to take something on in your family, and other people are not in a place to do that, that's okay. And so healing around that which cannot be healed is almost a respect of that. It's saying, I understand that you have endured so much and that maybe just taking that on just might put you over the edge. So I'm going to just keep moving, but I personally need to work through that. So that's, you know, that's a very big thing for people to kind of let go of the burden of, you know, putting that burden on the rest of their family in a way, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, in particular situations where really difficult things have been endured.
Right. Yeah. And you call, you know, forgiveness the holy grail of healing. And I think, you know, a lot of people talk about forgiveness. Not a lot of people really understand what it means.
Yeah. And if I can just talk about that for a minute, one of the things that, I have started doing workshops with people, and one of the really big things that we talk about in workshop is the difference between forgiveness and reconciliation, which I know we talk about later in the book, but it's a really important point because I think ultimately people are afraid of forgiveness because they think it implies, you know, a forced reconciliation. I mean, people will avoid forgiving somebody in their life because they think that's going to have to, it's going to require them to have a new relationship with them. Mm. And the truth is that forgiveness all takes place in your heart. It's just your heart's lens. You know, it's the way that you perceive that person and feel about them. It's not about the relationship you have with them. And so if people can start to feel safer in knowing that they have a license to forgive without needing to change the relationship, they can actually find forgiveness with people that maybe aren't even safe for them to have relationships with, but they can still forgive them and have compassion for them.
Right.
So I think that is, I think, yeah, you're absolutely right. There's a lot of talk going on right now about forgiveness, but it's a very tricky thing, and it requires a lot of stepping back and really getting calm and understanding what is forgiveness. And I think it's very close to compassion and very close to just having empathy for another human being. And once you enter into that place, you know, forgiveness just comes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And number three is that we're each on our own hero's journey. And you talk about Joseph Campbell, And I know you talk about that later, but you know, the, how Joseph Campbell used, you know, that we have separation, which I think we all tend to, well, we have to go through, and then transformation or initiation, and then the reintegration of it. And I, you know, to grow up, we do have to go through that. And I think a lot of us struggle on various aspects of that journey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's interesting, I think, in our culture today, you know, in Western culture, there's not, I mean, I think having a healthy adolescence is super important. And so, you know, having a space to kind of go off and be yourself is something that, if it's not done at the chronological age of, you know, 13, 14, 15, it's going to keep coming back at you. Mm-hmm. So I like that, because, and I think it's important for people to recognize that at some point in their life, they may need to take that adolescent journey, even if it's at 40 years old or 50 years old. And it may require that you take a break from your family, because if you keep repeating those patterns, if you keep being in relation to those people the same way you have been since you were 5, 6, 7 years old, you don't really give yourself a chance to change that. So reminding people that they are each on their own journey, and giving them sort of the freedom to let go of their family for a little while to enjoy that journey is an important thing.
Yeah, I think it's very important. And I think as you talk about the patterns, I mean, to break them for a little while, depending on, you know, how long that can be. But I mean, I think it's a necessary aspect of us, you know, of the journey that we're on. We have to break all of our patterns, and the patterns that we, you know, we developed as children are the patterns that we usually keep repeating until we understand them and can, you know, find a way to heal them.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And just trying to find ways to literally give ourselves permission to break those patterns. It really requires sometimes taking a break from certain relationships that keep us embedded in those patterns.
Mm-hmm. And number four, that we're not immune to environment, and this is where you do talk about David Berselli's book, but, you know, the ecosystem of our family. And I think I really like the way you've, you know, brought everything together. It's different from, you know, anything that I've read on this.
Yeah, and I think I really like the ecosystem model too, because there are so many subtle energies going on that we're oftentimes not letting ourselves experience. And as a family, where you physically live, the home that you live in, you know, the outside factors that are coming in and touching that family's life. I mean, there's so many things that are going on that are very subtle, and it's no different than any other ecosystem. And so to kind of come to a place where you can recognize those things as important and having an impact on what goes on in the family, it's just raising the consciousness of the family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, for sure. Yeah. Now you go in, and then the next part is about the nuclear family, and this we could probably talk the rest of the show on, because it's so huge, really. But you know, the essence, the authentic self, you know, how we're not necessarily nurtured, but you know, I love how you bring in, you know, the collective response to shame. And I think, you know, with your own family, there was a divorce at age 13, and I lost my father at 13. So, you know, we all seem to have, we all go through events that push us to grow, to evolve, depending on how we see them, depending on our reactions to them, depending on, you know, our life experience. It creates, you know, interesting dynamics our entire life. But the nuclear family, that part of the family is just really important.
It is. And I think it's interesting. I mean, when you lose a parent physically, I was just talking to somebody last night who lost both of her parents by the time she was 18 years old. And it's a different, I mean, certainly a different dynamic. But I think one of the hard things about divorce is that your parents are still here, mm-hmm. and there's the hope and promise of some kind of reconciliation or forgiveness or understanding that doesn't get fulfilled.
Mm-hmm.
So I've lost some people very close to me, certainly not a parent, you know, but or a sibling, but I've lost people really close to me, and I always think it's an interesting thing when people leave the planet, because you can then remember them in all their beauty. But when people are still alive and they're struggling for decades and decades with something, it's really hard to put that in a place that makes sense. And I think divorce is particularly hard on families because of the echoes that it puts out of, you know, it's a kind of a holding, it puts everybody in a holding pattern of, you know, this is something that happened that now we all have to sort of live with. But if you can move forward from divorce and find forgiveness with each other, as I think I've talked about before, it's so powerful, because then it's just, you know, it's something that everybody's going to go through, which is something difficult, but to be able to move beyond that is huge.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I'm describing that well, but I think, I think as I get older, I appreciate and have a lot of compassion for people who've been through that experience.
Right. And you know, again, this collective response to shame, I think it's a really big issue. You also have Jeff Brown as one of your people who supported your book. And, you know, his work is very much on right now looking at shame. And I think, you know, it's one of those areas that we really struggle with, because it's really there, and we don't know how to deal with it.
Yeah, and it also goes back to what we were talking about earlier about sharing, you know, putting things out there, and that's what I have so much respect for Jeff, because he has put himself out there. And like what you were mentioning about my story, I mean, he has shared his life in a way that few people do, and he's used that as his beacon. I mean, that's his beacon of light, to bring others in, you know, as if he's almost like a, he's just there and putting it out and turning the lights on and encouraging other people to come and follow that, like a lighthouse, basically. Mm-hmm. And ships coming by in the night where it's dark can see that lighthouse, and they can see him as that lighthouse, people who are going through that shift, and say, okay, it's going to be okay, because I see the lighthouse, I can see what's going on here. And, you know that I really, really love that expression, the collective response to shame, because that it's something that we are all dealing with. And if people can start to feel more sense of community around that other people are dealing with it too, it makes them more comfortable, it makes them less judgmental, and then they start opening up themselves.
Right. Or we go through that process of splitting, which you talk about, which is really, you know, splitting away from the first circle to the second circle, or, you know, moving away from that true essence that we sort of tuck away and try and protect. And through doing that, you know, we get into addictions and numbing ourselves and, you know, all the things that you talk about. I mean, it's very interesting what we do, what our ego wants to do, what our society has taught us to do to try and, you know, protect something that would be much more adept and equipped at dealing with these issues than when we split off and create a way that feels much more separate and much more alone.
Yeah. Well, and I think one of the things I when I was in therapy, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago, talking to someone, one of the things that he said that I always loved was, he said, you know, we were living at the time, very affluent, nice community of people. And he said, if you basically took the top off of every home in this community, you would see the same thing going on for one of them. And, you know, speaking from somebody who interacts with these people in a very intimate way, mm-hmm. I really, really appreciated that. And I carry that with me, because there is a sense that, you know, the persona of what people put out is one thing, and what people are suffering through and living with is another thing. And the more we can talk about it and make it real, the more it just dissipates. It just kind of goes away. And, you know, one of the topics I really want to start getting into in my next piece of work I'm doing now is around money, because I think that's another topic that's very, you know, there's a lot of collective shame around that. And once people can start opening up and talking about money and how it affects their life and how not having it has caused pain and, you know, all those kind of issues, and especially in the spiritual community, because there's, I think, there's sort of this almost like, you know what, it doesn't really matter. Money doesn't really matter. And if you're doing what you love to do, it's okay. But what if you're raising, you know, three children? It does matter. So I really like that whole idea of, you know, bringing things into the light, especially the things that some, you know, and I think Jeff talks about this a lot, some of the real things.
Right. Yeah. And so, again, the nuclear family, we then move into relationships. So we've left maybe the nuclear family of our, you know, growing up, and then we move into the nuclear family of a relationship. And so then we have to, you know, build new circles. We have to build a new way to relate in a way that's separate from, although we usually take on our patterns and behaviors and beliefs that our family instilled with us, and we try and place it into the role of the new nuclear family, and the other person has their own behaviors and beliefs and from their nuclear family. And so now you're trying to build, and this is where the separation, I think, from each family becomes very important, because you need to break those patterns. But it's fascinating, because it's again a whole new nuclear family that you're creating, that you have to then be very aware. And we're not taught to be how to be aware. We're not taught how to, you know, have a family and a healthy relationship and a healthy relationship with our children. We're not taught any of that. We're taught how to add numbers and subtract numbers, and, you know, we're taught about science, and we're taught about things that may help us in a job but doesn't help us in our life.
Wow. That's a really profound point. And, you know, I mean, and to those of you out there who were taught that, bless you. You know, I have a deep respect for that. It's mothers and fathers can teach their children these things, you know, not in a covert way, but in an open way. You know, these are the things that are important. But I think the interesting thing for me, and hearing you kind of summarize that, Rich and I moved to California when I was pregnant with our oldest son, so that was almost 15 years ago, just for that very reason. Then we knew that it was almost like a collective adolescence, but at the same time, trying to create a space to understand how are we going to raise a family? What is our family culture going to be? And we knew that, and no disrespect to our families, but that they were so powerful in our lives, in our own minds and our own perception of them, that if we didn't get out from under them, we were not going to figure that out. So, you know, we moved away, and there's a lot of things that are hard about that now. I mean, my kids don't have regular access to their grandparents. They don't have cousins and aunts and uncles like a lot of people do. But it gave us a chance to find out what our family culture was about and how are we going to blend together the collective experiences that we had and create a new culture. So I can really appreciate that, you know, what you're talking about there.
Yeah, well, and you know, that's what your book is all about. It's helping people to, you know, understand and see these circles in these families and how the impact of, you know, what happens within our own family dynamics and then trying to create something new. So that's what you're doing. I mean, you're helping people, you know, understand this, and hopefully through this, they can start teaching their kids about what it means to be, to growing up, to moving through some of this.
Yeah, and one other point I want to make about what you're saying, which is interesting. You know, you'd mentioned that our parents don't teach us this, and their culture doesn't even teach us this. They teach us all these other things that are, you know, somewhat important, but the goings on inside of a home, we're not really taught, you know, how to do that. But the thing that I love, that I think is sort of underrated, or is that your children will teach you that.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're open to that fact, your children will teach you everything. Your children will tell you the truth about what you're doing or not doing. And if you hear them, you're going to be fine. They are your best medicine. And your children know. They know the truth because they are embedded in the truth when they come onto the planet. They are real. And they understand how things should be innately because they're children. And I really look to my children to teach me, and I know my husband does also, what is the right way to do things. And, you know, we joke about my daughter who's 12 years old because she's so, I mean, I don't mean any disrespect to me, but she's so much more of a mother than I am. She understands things so deeply that she will keep reminding me over and over and over of what needs, you know, to change or what needs to be done. And, you know, ultimately I'm the grown-up and I have to keep making her feel safe in that fact. But I take in what she has to say, and I take in what my sons have to say. And for people who've grown up in families where maybe the modeling wasn't ideal, and certainly there was no teaching, as you talk about, you have right in front of you the teachers that you need, who, you know, who are your children.
Right. And talk about the triangles. I mean, I know people talk about triangles, but I really identified how you connected them, because I think they are unique. And that's when the sibling one became so real to me, because it's like, oh yeah, I mean, that's, you know, those triangles keep getting played out that we're just not aware of them. We're not aware of the dynamics of that triangle. So talk about that.
Yeah. Well, the thing with the triangles that, yeah. And then I find that so interesting too, is that when two people get married, there's a relationship there, and it's between two people. And then when a child comes into that family, you know, there is obviously a dynamic that goes on that is, it gets more complicated. And then when a second child is born, really, it's hard for those two children to have a relationship that does not involve the parent.
Mm-hmm.
So immediately, that second child is born into a triangle. I mean, the first child is in a sense too, but I think even more profoundly the second child, because they are then embedded in a situation where everything that goes on between them and their sibling usually has some involvement of the parent. So it is a very interesting relationship, and the sibling relationships that I know of that are successful, or, you know, people who are as adults or close as siblings, I have so much respect for that. And I think that parents who are involved in creating that positive relationship understand that that relationship is complicated. And so I'm not sure if I'm saying this right, but I know that the triangle, and, you know, in my book I use Sierpinski's triangle, which is interesting because it's based on fractals. And if you know, people who understand fractals, it's all about the infinite replication of something over and over, sort of within itself. I mean, and it's all through nature. I mean, if you go outside and you look at a tree, you know, and you look at the way that tree grows, it grows and then it branches off and then it branches off again. And each one of those spawning branches is an identical replica of the first set. And they've actually studied fractals in nature, and they've found that trees not only grow in that sense, but they grow at a specific distance from each other in the forest so that they can each have enough light and enough nutrients to grow properly. So if you bring that back again to the family and, you know, and to the circles, and the whole idea I have around nurturing a family and the balance there is an important thing about creating enough space to let everybody have their relationships. And one of the things as parents, I think, that is particularly challenging is, you know, letting the other people in the household have their own relationship without interfering with it. And that can be very challenging. You know, if somebody's had a stressful day, you know, if my husband comes home and he's had a stressful day and he's not at his best with the kids, it's all I can do to not get involved. And vice versa. But the thing is that the less that I get involved, the more real he's going to of an interaction he's going to have, and the quicker that that communication between him and, you know, whoever, if it's one of our children, is going to be. But the minute I step into that, it gets complicated, and then there's just a lot more interference and a lot more things in the communication chain that need to be unraveled. So I just think the triangle is so interesting because there's so many layers to once we sort of interject ourselves into another relationship with two other people, on whatever level that is, then everything gets very complicated. Mm-hmm. So just to be mindful of that in relationships and families, and understand that, you know, the triangle can be a good thing sometimes, whereas as Bowen talks about, it actually can relieve the pressure in a relationship. I mean, two people might be in a very intense bout with each other, and so by bringing a third person in, they're actually relieving the tension in that relationship, which is, you know, his theory about it. But at the same time, too much of that can hinder the actual reconciliation or, you know, resolution that might need to go on between those two people. So it's a big topic, and there's a lot that goes on, I think, with that. And in a family, you know, you have a tight space and a lot of people, you know, kind of living with a lot of stuff.
Right.
Every day.
Yeah. And it all gets mixed up into the nuclear family, and
Yeah. That's
how we sort of try and live, which is
Yeah. It's
fascinating, because if you know anything about energy and you know how our auras work and you know that everybody is in each other's aura when you're in each other in the home, and you know we're all picking up everybody's signals and everybody else's energy, and it can be quite an interesting experience.
and you know, I was in a business seminar a couple months back, and they had some folks come in and give a presentation and sort of a, you know, it was a team building workshop, basically, is what it was. And one of the things that they wanted everyone in the room to consider is, like, in your work environment, in your corporate work environment, who would you consider a team and who would you consider a group? And it was a very interesting idea because, you know, in a corporate environment, a certain set of people might get together and become a team. So they might bring somebody from the technology group, somebody from marketing, somebody from HR, and those people together will form a team, and they'll implement something. They'll be on a mission within the company. But then each of the departments is actually considered a group. You know, the technology people are a group, the HR people are a group, and maybe they're not really, they're all, they have similar functions, but they're not working towards a goal. They're just doing what they need to do to keep the company functioning. And I particularly thought that was interesting in taking that model and applying it to the family. And I am still not resolved about whether a family is a group or is it a team. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I think it's like, are you working towards the same goal or maybe not? You know, everybody in the family, we're born into a family with people that might be very, very different from us. I mean, aside from the marriage, no other relationship is chosen.
Yeah.
So we're dealing with these people that may or may not support us in our vision, and we as a family may not have a collective unified vision. So how do we make peace with that?
Yeah.
And I would love to hear your thoughts on that, because I think it's an interesting question.
Yeah. I mean, I like that. I mean, it's to actually, you know, want, I'm sure there are times in every family where we would be working towards a similar goal. And I think, you know, I mean, if we look at, take it broad enough, it's all about our own growth and, you know, understanding of our experience and enjoying the experience as much as possible. But I mean, there must be times when we are completely moving towards our own goals that would be very individual and not collective at all. Yeah, I think that that's, you know, I think if you can get a family to work together to create something where everybody is working towards, you know, a goal that is unified, I think that would certainly empower the family in a way that working individually would never do. And yet at the same time, we also need to recognize that we do have individual goals that also need to be assisted, but we are so much more powerful when we can work as a team. We're so much, that's something that everybody could benefit learning how to do, is to work as a team and then also to work as a group. So I think it would be beneficial to do both, but to have some common...
You're absolutely right, yeah. And it's a template. It's a template for how we deal with the rest of the world.
Yeah.
So if, like you're saying, I mean, if we can work collectively as a team, and maybe the goal is actually to support each other as individuals, I mean, ironically. So if we can learn to do that in our family, we can certainly go out into the world and feel more comfortable embracing differences.
Yeah.
And so if everybody in a family is allowed to truly be themselves, to be their authentic self, which I think is really hard to do, then they learn to have that experience and go into the world and embrace people of different, you know, culture, of different race, of different political views, of all those things. And if you can't do that in your family, you're not really going to be having too easy of a time doing it in the rest of the world.
Absolutely.
I mean, I'll just tell you a little story quickly. My oldest son is 14. He just, for the last 2 years, has been clamoring with us that he wants to go to boarding school.
Really?
And my husband and I are like, well, you're not going to boarding school. That's crazy. I mean, we would miss you. You're going to, you know, you're still little. There's, you know, why would we do that? And he happened to find one particular school that was just an amazing place. And even, you know, when Rich and I started looking more deeply at it, it was truly a place where kids were just engaged and they were living this amazing life. And so we became open to it, and we went there and we visited, and, you know, and then he got accepted, and it was an amazing thing. But it was all part of, as you say, you know, the teamwork of letting him become himself at an early age. And who are we to say that he can't do that? I mean, from our own selfish perspective, obviously, we don't want to not wake up and have breakfast with him for the next 4 years, you know?
Right.
But in other cultures, people go off on their walkabout at 14 years old, you know? So it's not so strange that he, at this age, I mean, I am more and more proud now that he actually feels so confident in himself that he can go off and do that.
Yeah.
And it if you start putting some judgment on it and start looking at it, you know, in a classical, critical way, it's like, wow, that's just wrong. But that at the same time, you know, that's not so wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh. Yeah, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the circles. And I love how you know, combined it with the family tree, or just even, you know, the whole balancing of the rings of a tree when you open the trunk to see, you know, how its life progressed and the way the five circles are to, you know, to be nurtured and balanced so that we, you know, we're not, and you sort of already talked about it between the second one and the first one, but let's talk about the circles.
Yeah. I mean, the whole thing about the tree and the circles of a tree, like you're saying, if you take a tree and you cut it, at the base, and you look at the circles, they say that you can tell, you know, each ring represents a year, and you can tell looking at those rings if the tree experienced a nurtured year of good sunlight and good water and nutrients, or if there was a year that was hard where there weren't those things, and the tree, you know, the rings in the tree will reflect that. And I really love that, because I think families are like that. And then we as individuals are also like that in our experiences of our self and in relation to our family. And the thing that strikes me about that is that time keeps kind of marching forward. And in a family, we may go through really barren years or really difficult years. Or as David Berzelii points out, we may be processing some trauma that came through a collective experience of our culture. It could be war, it could be the depression, or, you know, what we're going through right now. Mm-hmm. And then that reverberates through certain years within a family tree. So if you can recognize that and see that there may be certain episodes or periods of life for a family that were difficult, then you can start to at least trace them as a scientist would and look at them and say, well, that was a particularly hard year. You know, I live up in Northern California where they grow grapes for wine, and it's like, well, that was a bad year for the grapes. I mean, that could be a way of looking at your family's situation. And by doing that, I think we sort of take the burden off of the individuals. I think there's a lot of controversy for me around the diagnostic aspect of, you know, a family member who has a certain mental illness or has a certain deficiency and wasn't able to parent well. And those things are all true, but what I like to look at is the bigger picture of, well, what did the family go through and what did the culture go through and how have those things affected who we are in our family? And by doing that, we can come back to a place of forgiveness and compassion, because then we can release ourselves from the blame. And not to say we release ourselves from responsibility, but release ourselves from looking at everything in terms of, well, this person is what really, you know, this is the person in the family who made everything bad. You know, instead, looking at, well, what did that person go through that they were not as functional or couldn't be as good of a parent as they might have been?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So the circles, what's the first circle?
So looking at the circles, the first circle is the authentic self. It's the self that we are born into the world with, the self that is innately who we are. Our true self is really what I call it. And then the second circle is your ego and your body. I think this is a lot of the work that David Berselli does around understanding what does our body hold, what does our ego hold, how is it protecting us, but at the same time, how is it holding us back from, you know, true integration. The third circle is our growing family, or the family that we live with on a day-to-day basis, and how we function in that family. And the fourth circle is our life outside of our family, and that can include our career, our livelihood, our extended family, a lot of things. And the fifth circle is the place within the world, how we see the world, our spirituality, our sense of meaning, you know, how do we fit into the universe? And it's really the three inner circles, the second, third, and fourth circles, where our work is. And when we could do the work in those circles, then the first circle and the fifth circle become connected. And for a lot of people, they may not even have a chance to experience their fifth circle in the sense of, like, understanding the world at large, the universe, in a way that makes sense, because they're very caught up in trying to just live their day-to-day survival. And that's why I think the three inner circles are important, because it's really where we do our work. It's where we kind of keep revisiting and keep finding meaning and keep turning the lights on around the things that have been challenging for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think that's really, I want to say wise. I mean, I think when we understand, you know, we don't often get to the fifth circle until we have a good handle on the inner three, and, you know, how the fifth and the first work together are, you know, very important, especially if you're wanting, you know, to be an aspect of the spiritual journey, to bring in the spiritual part of it. And certainly the second circle is where we sort of hide our true essence, and we spend all that time, you know, being inauthentic to pretend we're protecting.
Yeah.
Something.
Yes, pretend we're protecting something. I love that. That's true. Pretend. What are we protecting? Well, it goes back to what we were talking about earlier about being real and taking the risk and putting out there, like, the shame, like Jeff Brown talks about, and how the more that we can do that, the more that stuff just falls away.
Yeah.
But we are pretending we're protecting something. It's so true. It's absolutely true.
Yeah. And we spend so much time, you know, building up these walls that we end up having to then spend even more time trying to disassemble them because they're not necessarily, and they're stopping us from truly living.
Yeah. Well, and I, you know, a couple of the other people I draw on in my book around that are, you know, Carolyn Meese, who talks about the tribe, you know, and what happens when we betray the tribe. And sometimes the betrayal of the tribe is actually us trying to be authentic. So, you know, that's one thing. And then if you look at Alice Miller's work, the drama of the gifted child, where she talks about, as children, when we are faced with the choice of choosing our parents or choosing ourselves, we will choose our parents because we are dependent on them for our survival. So if that means giving up our authentic self to survive, we will do that. And then years later, when it's safe, we will start to dismantle the false self that we've created. If we're lucky, we have an opportunity to do that. We will start to dismantle that false self. And your analogy of, like, you know, you spend all this time building it up and then all this time taking it down, it just comes back to that team versus group and trying to find a way to let everybody be authentic, which can be very challenging because it may not meet the agenda of what's going on.
Yeah, it's an interesting journey that we put ourselves on.
Yeah, and amazing that we choose to even have families after everything we've been through. But I guess that's the point.
I think it is.
And
so we've talked about healing and forgiveness, but it's, you know, it is the important step in, I guess, reconnecting all of the pieces and bringing all of the circles together and allowing ourselves to live that authentic self or to be that authentic self.
Yeah. And I think ultimately what I hope to communicate and to bring people together around is the idea that despite whatever you have been through, you know, that if you can find a place now to have compassion for your family members in light of that, that is just a great place to start the journey of moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really, really a difficult and challenging thing for people to understand that your parents, although, you know, whatever they have inflicted on you, that they were probably victims of the same thing themselves. And that's, you know, that's the message I really hope to put out into the world, is just, can you find forgiveness for your ancestors, for your parents, for your grandparents, and understand that whatever you're struggling with, they're probably struggling with it too.
Mm-hmm. And your siblings, because those triangles that were created in the family and the way your siblings had to, you know, they would have had a different dynamic. And yet, you know, what you saw was probably quite different than what they experienced, because our perspective is everything. And it's how we sort of see the world, but it's often very skewed in our own interpretation of how we experience the world.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's really true, because some siblings will have, I mean, my husband is one of 8 children. And so over the course of 11 years, you know, those children were all born, but the younger children had a very different experience than the older children of their parents. They had a completely different reality. So I think the challenge as adults then becomes, you know, how can you honor each other's separate perception and reality? And that's part of the healing process too.
And then you have a chapter on coming home,
mm-hmm.
and setting the parents free to heal, as well as, oh, I love the grafting the apple tree.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've been, just for anybody who's interested, I've been doing a little guest writing on the Namaste Publishing website this week. And I did a piece on grafting the apple tree. And it was spawned by my daughter, who came home one day from school and she said, "Mom, you know, it's very interesting because we just moved into a new community a couple of years ago, and she's been sort of taking a little inventory of everybody she meets in a family dynamic way." And she came to me and she said, "It's very interesting, Mom. Some kids have, they live with their grandparents, but they don't have, a parent might be deceased or missing completely from the picture, but they have grandparents. Other people have, you know, aunts and uncles or a lot of siblings. And then us, you know, we have each other, but we don't have a lot of relatives close by." Hmm. And she sort of brought forth this image of balance to me that I never really thought about. She was basically saying, you know, see, it kind of works out for everybody. Hmm. And I think the grafting the apple tree image is really good because it reminds people that family is not always along bloodlines. Family can take other shapes and forms. And once we welcome that and embrace it, we can start to also heal some of our issues of not feeling like we have real family.
Right. Right. Hmm. Now, you ended your book with love letters. And I think, you know, that's a powerful way, one, to come to that humility and to a place of forgiveness. But talk about the love letters.
Well, I'm a big fan of letter writing, and it's definitely a transforming, I mean, the form of letter writing is transforming rapidly with the internet and email and everything. But I always admired, as you probably read about in the book, I always admired Lady Diana and how she said that she never would let more than 48 hours go by without sending a thank you note to somebody for anything. And I just think that the love and intention that goes into writing a letter, like especially today, you know, physically sitting down and writing a letter and then putting it in the mail and somebody receiving that, it's just a wonderful expression of love. And to remember that people can do that at any time, and it's a gift. And I even sometimes, you know, this Christmas, for instance, when we were trying to not spend as much money like everybody else, that was one of the things I encourage people to do, is maybe you can't give each other that big gift this year, but maybe you could write each other a letter, even though you're living under the same roof. I mean, how powerful is that, to have a letter written to you to remind you of what you mean to somebody? Mm-hmm. And we do a lot of work around letters in the workshops, and one of the things that we try to do is having people read these letters. Maybe you don't even have to send that letter off to the person that you are in some kind of conflict with. Maybe you can just read it to somebody else as a witness to how you feel about them and what you want to share with them. And that can be very powerful too. So there are sort of many different ways that letters can be used to help people heal. And just, it gives you a chance to slow down and to start really putting your thoughts together with gratitude around what that person might mean to you in your life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think it's a lovely idea that people, you know, again, we take certain things for granted. And if we could learn to open up in different ways, and, you know, you give guidelines on how to write them in the book. And, you know, I just think it's a really powerful experience for people to open themselves up to looking at the world from different perspectives and different ways. And it can really help in healing. And certainly with people that you are having conflict with, would be, you know, a wonderful opportunity, whether you give it to them or not. It just helps you see things from different perspectives.
That's right. And just exactly. I mean, when you can slow down and start to gain that perspective and start to imagine that person receiving what you are sharing with them, but also understanding, taking some time to understand maybe where they sit.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to also encourage people when they're writing their letters to remember that, you know, as I say, letters, they should be gifts, not grenades. And you should be mindful of not saying something in a letter that you wouldn't say to somebody in person. It's not really, it's not a vehicle to try to communicate something that you're not ready to, you know, a conversation you're not ready to have.
Right.
It should just be a way of sharing some love and something that maybe you feel hasn't been shared before, but in a non-threatening way, in a way that is, you know, is full of compassion and love, really.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, Johanna, this has been a wonderful interview. I've very much enjoyed it. I look forward to hearing your new book about, you know, the shame around money, because I think that I think that's a big one, especially these days. Tell people how they can get a hold of you, and if you're doing any workshops or anything coming up.
You can certainly read about everything that I'm doing on my website, which is theprodigalfamily.com. And we are trying to expand our workshops to include more physical locations. Right now we're focused in the Bay Area, so you can read about anything we have going on there, which will be in April. I'm hoping to have 3 or 4 more workshops happening in Marin and Northern California in the city. So check in there if you want to see what's going on.
Cool. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Lori. It's been a great conversation. It's always interesting to have a chance to look at the book in a new way with somebody who's had a great perspective on it, as you have.
Thank you. Yeah. I did enjoy it. And I think people, you know, if they want to understand their families better, and to help their children, it's a great book to make you think.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
You're welcome. All right.
Okay.
Take
care. Have a good rest of your evening.
You too.
Okay. Talk to you later.